Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again this week, we're interviewing an old-timer who is now living outside, but who can't resist the call of the Northland for an occasional visit. We're recording on Friday, which is the 73rd birthday of our guest this evening. I'd like to introduce you to Morris Godding. I know many of you know him here in the Fairbanks area, and particularly many of you know his daughters, Evelyn Franich, who still lives in Fairbanks, and Marge Smith, who's in the office of Delegate Bartlett in Washington, D.C.
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Godding, when did you first come to Alaska?
It was in the Washington's birthday in 1902, February 22nd.
Well, how long did you remain in Alaska on your first time?
Well, I went out first in 42 and then returned and stayed until the fall of 43 when I finally retired.
Then you had over 40 years in Alaska.
41 to be exact.
Well, that's about 40 more than you need to be a sourdough, isn't that right?
Well, I think a one-year sourdough is kind of an upstart myself.
Where did you spend most of your days in Alaska?
Well, of course, we had to have one little turn at prospecting, and then I found that I went to work for the White Pass Railroad, and I remained with them all my time here.
Well, that's a line that has always fascinated me. It's still in operation, isn't it, and going strong?
Yes, it was built to take care of the Klondike Gold Rush, and I don't believe the builders anticipated that it would ever be permanent. But there's always something come along to boost the little railroad, and it sometimes would get down in the dumps, but there would always something come along to give it a boost, and it's still going strong. And now it's using diesel locomotives.
I believe I read here recently that it was getting its first diesel engines just this year.
Yes, I believe they're just putting them into service.
And it's still narrow gauge, isn't it?
It's still narrow gauge. That's one of the features of that road.
Uh-huh. Well, were you there during the actual building of the railroad?
No, the road had been completed before I got there. But, everybody still had the gold fever at that time, and if they were working, it was because maybe they needed a grub stake or something to get out in the hills.
Must have made construction work sort of spasmodic.
I believe during construction they did have trouble keeping men. As soon as they would get a stake, they would be off prospecting again.
Hmm. Well, you didn't have too much luck in prospecting, is that right?
Well, I had a lot of fun, but perhaps I was just a boy and it was kind of an adventure to me, and perhaps I didn't take my prospecting too seriously.
Well, in what capacity did you work with the railroad?
In the locomotive department, I went from the roundhouse up, and when I left, I was senior engineer.
Hmm.
And when the Army came and took our railroad over during the days of building the Alcan Highway, I went back and, in a sort of a supervisory capacity, to kind of coach the boys to get along. Some of them hadn't had any experience in snow, and that was quite necessary on this road.
Well, it's pretty treacherous country, isn't it, for railroading down in there?
Well, I think some of the men were rather surprised that came there. They were at first a little bit inclined to sneer at our little railroad, but by the time they'd operated and tried to operate, they had a great deal of respect for it.
Well, as far as actual layout of the tracks, is it mostly through a mountain area?
Well, our first 20 miles, you know, climbs right up pretty nearly 3,000 feet.
Is that right?
Which is, as any railroader knows, is a steep grade.
Mm, it certainly is. Were you ever on a train that ran into any extreme difficulties?
Oh, naturally, we had our troubles, and some rather serious and some not so bad. Occasionally, we've been tied up in snow that kept us there for a long time.
Well, did the slides ever just actually knock the tracks out?
Well, one very sad experience, a rock slide, took a locomotive right out of the middle of the train. The engineer and the fireman both lost their lives, and that was the saddest experience that I had.
Well, during your days of prospecting, I was quoted something that you said at one time that particularly interested me, that we've never talked much about the food and food habits of the prospectors. And I think you said that given some salt, a man could just about live off the country.
Well, I believe that's true, and I think most any old-timer will bear me out in saying that if a man is in any way resourceful. A little salt, and he can get by.
Well, there is one thing now. I've read about it many times, and I've heard the old-timers and even our present-day prospectors and mountain climbers always talk about having tea on the trail instead of coffee. Now, coffee is such a universally popular beverage. Why is it that you don't make coffee when you're out in the...
Well, I think the answer is very evident. If you would try to pack 10 pounds of coffee, it would be quite a bulky package.
Mm-hmm.
But a pound of tea would perhaps go as far, and you could put it in your pocket.
There are times, I guess, when they used to just chew the tea leaves when they couldn't get water. And...
Well, I presume that's the case, yes.
The one thing that is very typically Alaskan as far as food is concerned, of course, is the sourdough starter, the sourdough hotcakes. And at the risk of turning this into a recipe hour, I'd like it very much if Mr. Godding would tell you about his own particular recipe for sourdough. And I have a copy of it here that was printed in the Turlock, California Daily Journal. That's where you're living now,
yes,
isn't it? Turlock. That's up in what area?
It's near San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the San Joaquin Valley.
There's quite a nice article about sourdough in that, and I wonder if you just read off the recipe for us. There might be a lot of people who'd like to copy it down. I know I certainly did, because even after several years in Alaska, I've never made sourdough hotcakes.
Well, the starter would be, as we used to make it, take 2 cups of flour, mix it with a teaspoonful of salt, and about a half a teaspoonful of dry yeast, and 2 cups of lukewarm water, and about 3 tablespoonfuls of sugar. You stir that up into a smooth paste and put it in a warm spot where it could stay warm, and stir it up 2 or 3 times a day, and in 2 or 3 days it would be ready to use.
And then what do you do to make the hot cakes?
Well, the night before, you'd add to the starter perhaps 2 cups of flour and a tablespoon of sugar, and a half a teaspoon of salt, and about 2 cups of water to make a thick paste. And you'd let this work overnight. It would thin down some. But in the morning, you'd leave a cup of the starter in a bowl for your next time. And to the remainder, you could add 2 tablespoons of sugar and a teaspoon of salt, 3 tablespoons of melted fat. Probably you'd use bacon grease because that's the fat available. And an egg, if you had one, if you were lucky enough. Then you'd want a teaspoon of soda dissolved in a little water. And if the batter's too thick, add a little more water. And fold in the soda solution. And bake on a hot greased griddle. And I think you'll find them okay.
Well, are there any places left that you know of that still commercialize on the original starter?
Well, I've seen restaurants advertising that their sourdough hotcakes have been going since the days of the gold rush. The last time I was in Ketchikan, there was a restaurant there that advertised such hot cakes, and I went in, and they really were good.
Huh. Well, a cup of starter, I guess, can be a pretty valuable thing. Your daughter Evelyn was telling me that Bob Bartlett very carefully treasured a cup on his lap all the way back to Washington, D.C.
he did, and I assure you they enjoyed it back there, and they made quite a feature of it.
Huh. Well, now, back in the early days in Skagway, besides the mining, was there much in the way of industry? What else did people do?
Well, Skagway was just literally a little railroad town there. The White Pass Railroad was the only thing that kept that town.
Did tourists become attractive to Alaska at that early day?
Well, when tourists first began to come, they were interested in the country, but we were so busy handling freight, getting it over to the mines, that we didn't want to bother with the tourists.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we began to cater to the tourists, and now the tourists are quite a feature of the White Pass business.
What were some of the first tourist features that were put up at Skagway?
The tourist fund?
Features, attractions. Do you remember anything that was done in the way of an enterprise or a business?
Of course, we put up a marker on Soapy Smith's grave. And incidentally, that was taken away piecemeal by the tourists.
Is that right?
Until finally they put up a marker and enclosed it in an iron frame, so that now I don't believe they can get a chunk of it. I always said that Soapy Smith has had far more victims since he's dead than ever before when he was alive.
What about transportation? Did they have any kind of buses, or did they have horse and buggies, or...
Well, of course, in the early days, we didn't have any cars. Later on, we began to have a few Ford cars. And one of our enterprising citizens, Martin Itchen, he built himself the only streetcar in Alaska, as he advertised it. And he was really wonderful entertaining the tourists. He had a dummy of Soapy Smith on the front of his car. And Martin had a pipey little voice, but you old-timers all remember him. And he had a great way of kidding the ladies, but incidentally he would take them up and show them how gold, how they prospected for gold. And he really had a wonderful, and I think he did very well at it.
Hmm.
He was an undertaker, by the way, but he always used to make a joke out of that. He said he arranged with the doctors to keep the patients alive till winter when he had no tourists to bother with. And in that way, but he always said, if you live long enough, I'll get you one way or the other.
Isn't that something? Well, on your trip back up this time, I know you just came back to Alaska this week. Did you stop back down in the Skagway area at all?
I haven't, but I hope to on my way south.
Do you still have a lot of friends down there, people you remember?
I still hope to see some of the old-timers there, although they tell me that I'll be amazed at the little old town.
Really booming now, huh?
Well,
now let me ask you, I'm always interested when our guests come back to Alaska, if they've encountered any old-timers recently in the area where they live, any former Alaskans?
Well, occasionally you see some, but where I am particularly, I haven't run across anyone that I could really know.
You just occasionally run into
them? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your days on the railroad, do you really consider that your highlight of your experiences in Alaska, or did you sort of enjoy the prospecting more?
Oh, of course, my railroading days are what I think of now. My prospecting summer and fall was rather incidental, you might say. It was intensely interesting, and I've always been glad I did it. But
it was pretty much the goal, though, that brought you to Alaska.
Well, yes, of course. Service says you come to get rich.
Speaking of service, do you quote service at all?
Oh, naturally we shoot Dan McGreal now and then, and we roast Sam McGee.
Why don't you just give us a few lines of service? That's something we haven't had on the program yet.
What would you like?
Oh, anything.
A bunch of the boys were hooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. Is that the one?
Sure, that's a good one.
The kid that handled the music box was hitting a jagtime tune. Back at the bar in the solo game was Dangerous Dan McGrew. And watching his luck was his light of love, the lady known as Lou. You don't want any more of that.
We have here in Fairbanks, you might be interested, Dan Lehman and his wife, Lou.
Oh, yes.
Who do a terrific job on that, I guess, because their names are the same, and so frequently you see them out doing and acting
the
old Robert Service poem. Well, Mr. Godden, we want to thank you for being our guest. It's certainly been enjoyable having you up here, and we're glad to see you back in Alaska for a visit.
Well, I want to tell you that this is my 73rd birthday, and being back here has added... But this is about the best birthday I've ever had.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Each Sunday night, we're privileged to introduce another of Alaska's old-timers to you. This week, we're going to depart a bit from our regular procedure and salute not just one, but all of the old-timers who came to Alaska during the Gold Rush days, and many of whom have stayed here throughout the years, made the territory their home. Tonight we're privileged to have the rebroadcast of a program this week at Pedro Monument, a program dedicated to Felix Pedro, the man who made the gold strike in the Fairbanks area. Throughout this week, activities commemorating the 52nd anniversary of the discovery of gold have been in progress. We feel that it's only appropriate to wind up this week with a dedication ceremony. I'd like to introduce to you at this time a man who has been in Fairbanks since 1902. He was the first man to come to Fairbanks that year as part of the gold stampede, Gus Conrad.
Mr. President, brothers and sister pioneers of Alaska, distinguished visitors, ladies and gentlemen, Jessens Weekly last week chose four very appropriate and proper words when eulogizing the life of our pioneer prospector and miner, Felix Pedro. He started it all. How very true. So today we are here to again commemorate and paid tribute to him who 52 years ago, not far from where we stand, made the first discovery of gold in this wonderful Tanana Valley. How little did he realize what it would all result in, for by his discovery started the wheels of progress moving toward the development of the vast interior of Alaska. Another pioneer, Captain E.T. Barnett, in 1901, had built a trading post on the Machina River, and due to Pedro's discovery, became the town of Fairbanks, destined to become the leading city in all interior of Alaska, and become an everlasting monument to Felix Pedro. By fall of 1902, the United States Signal Corps completed the Alaska Communication Service, linking the Port of Valdez to Eagle City on the Yukon River, thence from there across to the Tanana River to Fort Gibbon on the Yukon, and down the Yukon to St. Michael's and Nome. On the banks of the Tanana River, just below the mouth of the Chena River, was built a United States Signal Corps station in charge of two operators and two linemen. Two United States Signal Corps officers, Lieutenant William Mitchell at Eagle and Lieutenant George Gibbs at Fort Gibbon, had charge of this division. Lieutenant Gibbs arrived at Chena during December 1902 on 12 inspection and visited Pedro's claim together with Captain Barnett. Lieutenant Gibbs sent a telegram to the commander at St. Michael's about Pedro's find. The news being picked up along the line caused a stampede from rampart miners and waypoints on the Yukon. There was a signal station located at Glen Gulch, where I was mining, in the lower Tanana Valley, and heard of Lieutenant Gibbs's report of Pedro's find. I went to rampart, where I picked up a fine dog team and outfitted for the trip to China with a traveling companion, Bill Salmon, a former U.S. mail carrier. We were the first stampeders to reach Frank Mace and Marston's Roadhouse, located where the pastime now stands, corner of First Avenue and Cushman Street, on Christmas night, 1902. Fairbanks received its name in 1903. After resting a couple of days, I drove my dogs out to Discovery Claim on Pedro Creek, and there met Felix Pedro and Ed Quinn. Had my lunch with Felix and Quinn, and spent a few pleasant hours with them. I received much valuable information from Pedro, informing me of open ground subject to location on Goldstream Creek. Found Pedro to be a very courteous and of kindly disposition. Met him many times later, when I too became a mining operator on Esther Creek. Due to Pedro's find and discovery, Fairbanks became one of the leading gold mining camps of the world, equaling that of Dawson, Yukon Territory, and Nome on the Bering Coast. Fairbanks has emerged from a small mining camp to become a metropolis with the Alaska Railroad and highways connecting, resulting with the University of Alaska being built here, the United States Air Force at Ladfield, and aviation transportation throughout the territory. So let us not forget that all this has been brought about through the efforts and ability of this one great man, Felix Pedro, for he did it all. It was only natural for Pedro, after getting prospects, to inform his former friends at Circle to come over and locate mining ground. So it developed that Jack and Frank Coster, Thomas Gilmore, Dan McCarty Jr. located ground on Pedro Creek. On Fairbanks Creek, Dennis Shea, Dan McCarty Sr., Matt Meehan and Larson, George Poe, James Funchen, and Mike Stepovich made history of that creek. Clary Creek was located by such old-timers as Jesse Noble, Al Hilty, Fred Bleeker, Jack Ross, Herb Wilson, Frank Larson, and Sam Wise. Goldstream, we find Harry Atwood, Ed Erickson, Dave Cascaden, James Russell, and James McPike. Esther Creek was discovered by Jack Mahalsik, George Haskins, George McCrory in the spring of 1903. I knew all these wonderful men and feel we owe them who contributed in the upbuilding and development of Fairbanks a debt of gratitude and a share in the honors due them as great pioneers. I thank you.
Following Gus Conrad's speech, Robert J. McKenna, president of the Pioneers of Alaska, who had been master of ceremonies for the day's event, called forth historian for the Pioneers, Frank Chapados, to place a wreath upon the monument.
Before we place the wreath on the memorial, we'd like to recite a portion of part of the ritual of the Pioneers, which describes or defines the word pioneer. The word pioneer was originally used to designate those soldiers who were sent ahead of the main armies to prepare the way. It is our privilege as pioneers to prepare the way for the peaceful armies of civilization. Beginning in the Far East, the cradle of man, the pioneers have ever pushed westward, blazing their way across the plains and across the seas, finally reached our continent. Still, the pioneers pushed westward and finally reached our own Alaska. With the passing of the pioneers of Alaska, this hardy class of free men who have paved the way for the advancing armies of civilization for thousands of years will be no more. Alaska is the last great frontier. And now I take great pleasure in placing this wreath at the base of this monument in honor of Felix Pedro, who was truly a great pioneer.
Brother pioneers, Ladies of the auxiliary, ladies of the women, pioneers, distinguished guests, and visitors, I now have the pleasure of introducing to you two pioneers who are very active in the life of Alaska and are to show you what a pioneer is. Our governor was on his way with Secretary McKay to Kotzebue. Yesterday, I asked the secretary if it would be possible to allow the governor to stop off and come to this celebration. He said he thought it would. So I contacted the governor. He said he'd be more than glad to. Now, our other distinguished guest, who we all know and had his fingers on the life of Alaska, done practically the same thing. That's our delegate, Bob Bartlett. Bob was on another tour going south with Adlai Stevenson, who ran for President of the United States in 1952. We contacted Bob and asked him if it would be possible to be here to give a few remarks at this dedication. Bob said there'd be nothing better that he would like to do than to be here. I make these remarks to show you what it is to be a pioneer. To be a pioneer, you just don't say, well, I'd like to be a pioneer. You have to give 30 years of the best part of your life to the territory of Alaska.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, to echo the words of Robert J. McKenna, president of the Pioneers, is just what the Pioneers of Alaska have done. Perhaps you thought it a bit incongruous to hear the airplanes roaring over Mr. McKenna's head as he spoke to the audience at Pedro Dome. The pioneers who braved the trail 50 years ago had no such means of mechanism, transportation at their use. They walked into Alaska. Those that have been on the program today and their many friends are still here. We hope to meet additional pioneers at our microphone in the weeks ahead.
It was their courage and their hard work that made possible the civilization or the development of Alaska. And certainly it was the pushing back of the wilderness, which they were responsible for, that made these towns and cities and industries of today a reality. Now, in part payment to the debt that we owe to these early people, I think it is very fitting that we should try to perpetuate their memories and their names. I think it is a very fine project of the pioneers of Alaska to do that very thing. And I think it is very fitting indeed for the Fairbanks Igloo number 4 in following that fine tradition to sponsor this commemoration today of this monument and the memory of Felix Pedro, and to co-sponsor, I understand, the Discovery Day celebration which we have in Fairbanks. Now, there are a great many pioneers, of course. There have been a great many pioneers in this country. Some of their names are remembered in the creeks and the gullies and the hills where they worked, and we must say, too, where many of them died. There also are a great many more who have not been remembered in that way. I think, therefore, today that we should consider that the celebration that we are holding here should be in recognition and in respect of all the early pioneers of Alaska. Now, in this year, 1954, we are, or many of us, are very elected, I think, as pioneering as being a thing of the past, something perhaps that went out 30 years ago. Well, a man with a gold pan and a pick and shovel and starting out into the hills is certainly a true pioneer. But there is still a lot of pioneering work to do. A few days ago, I attended the dedication of a huge pulp mill in Ketchikan, a $52 million venture. That, too, was really a pioneering project.
of the present-day methods. It was the risking of a tremendous sum of money in a new pulp-making country. Similarly, we have people today that are risking great sums of money in explorations for oil. That is pioneering in a sense. We also see a lot of pioneering ahead in things that have to be done, new methods that have to be developed in connection with mining and also in connection with the development and use of many of the natural resources with which Alaska is so bountifully endowed. Now, I think one of the greatest resources that Alaska has, and one of its best assets, is a pioneer spirit. A pioneer spirit that's founded very much on hard work, on enthusiasm, on courage, on willingness to try new things and willingness to take chances. Those are things on which we must depend for the future. And I say it's pioneering. It's a very fine thing indeed for the pioneers of Alaska to commemorate and honor the memories of these early pioneers. But also, I think we will be doing a very good job indeed if we try to nurture and to foster the pioneer spirit among the young people of this territory and among the newcomers. With this spirit, that is the spirit of Felix Pedro, I am sure that Alaska is bound to go ahead, and we're certain to make progress, perhaps greater progress than even many of us imagine at the present time. I thank you very much, gentlemen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We don't discuss politics as such on this program, but tonight it would be difficult to veer completely away from politics because we have with us a man who was a public servant on the first Alaska legislature and who still has a very active finger in the political pie. In fact, he's on his way right now. He passed through Fairbanks en route to Juneau for a session of the Legislative Council. I won't tell you what his affiliation is, but I do want to tell you a little story about our guest. When his picture appeared in Pick magazine and the caption said, "Doesn't this man look like Harry Truman?" he was quoted as saying, "That's where the similarity ends." I'd like at this time to introduce Charlie Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, you've had a really long career in Alaska politics.
54 years I've been in here, and I joined the Republican Party the first year that I was in Alaska.
Well, now, in the first legislative session, how did they ever get organized? It must have been a hassle.
Well, we had Nels Fences from Wrangell, who had served in the Washington legislature. We had Milo Kelly from Kinnick, who had served in the Oregon legislature. And we had Judge Bruner from Nome, Elwood Bruner, who had served in the California legislature. We had a copy of one of the proceedings of the Oregon legislature, and on that we organized and started in. Ernest Collins was elected Speaker of the House, and H.T. Ray from Seward was elected President of the Senate. And of all of the members of that first legislature, Henry Roden and Ernest Collins and I are all that are left. The rest of them are, Dan Sutherland, beg your pardon. There's four of us, all of us left of that first group of men.
Are any others now besides you and Henry Roden still active in Alaska politics? I'm not familiar with the other two names.
No. Collins, he has retired from here. He was a lawyer here in Fairbanks mm-hmm. for years, and he's retired and spends most of his time out at, I believe, Harding Lake or mm-hmm. some lake out there. And Dan Sutherland is living in Maryland or Virginia, close to Maryland, right on the border there.
Well, what were some of the big problems that faced you? Of course, every session has its problems, but what was... Now, this was the year what?
1913.
And what was happening to Alaska then that was really important in the legislature?
Well, we did not know how much of a tax duplicate we could raise. We had nothing to go by. It all had to be by conjecture. And in the measures that we introduced and the offices that we created, we had to be careful that we didn't create a debt instead of going on what we collected. And in the Wickersham Bill creating the legislature, it had said we could impose other and additional duties on the federal officials. So that some of the officers we did not create, but placed that duties on the clerk of the court, the judge, and the district attorneys in the various divisions. I believe we did create the Office of Treasurer. The record will show that all right enough. And as it happened, we were very successful in collecting more revenue than we expended, mm-hmm. so that we had a balance when the 1915 legislature came in there.
But you didn't have any census figures to work from, anything. You didn't know how many people you had, did you?
No, really. In reality, we didn't. And another thing was, in creating the voting precincts, it had been a rather hit-and-miss matter, and some places people were missed, and other places we only had four or five or six people in a voting precinct, hardly enough to create to get the officers to run the election.
Mm-hmm.
And in that matter, that all had to be experienced and bring it around to the, so that it worked efficiently.
Well, now I must insert at this point that you evidently didn't like your first taste of politics too well, because you sure stayed out of them for a lot of years after that first session.
Well, I was defeated a couple of times after that, but I was so busy after that I didn't have time any more than I'd contribute to the campaign fund and do all I could to elect our Republican members, and wasn't any too successful.
Mm-hmm.
But we did go along, and then I was appointed United States Marshal, and I also acted as superintendent of the Alaska Road Commission, so that in the wintertime, I would prospect all the time, and I lived a pretty busy life. And then I raised a family of three children, and a man doing that, he's kept pretty busy.
Well, that's right.
Two of them girls, so that I had three women bossing me. And
you finally got back into politics and went away to legislature in self-defense, huh?
Well, they're all married now and uh-huh. have children of their own, and so that I don't have any of that. Only I can throw the glass through the window if I want to, and I can not sweep the floor or not make up the bed, and it's my own pleasure.
Well, now, in your early jobs at Nome, you say you've worked with the road commissioner as a marshal. What years were you in the marshal's office?
I was appointed by Judge Loman on the death of a man named Griffith, and that was during Coolidge's administration, and he reappointed me, and then Hoover appointed me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in, I think, a bit over 8 years, very close to 9 years I served as United States Marshal of the 2nd Division there.
Well, how about law enforcement problems? That area, we think of it as being a bit remote, and I guess maybe in those days it's still sparsely settled.
It is. Well, we were not... I was there in the Prohibition area, and anyone that lived through that knows that that was a pretty strenuous job.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look through the law books and see the decisions that are rendered on search and seizure, you'll find how careful one had to be when they did make a search. And I was very busy. A lot of the boys I had to arrest that I'd been drunk with myself, which wasn't very pleasant.
Well, now, when Alaska was first, when we first had judges up here, I don't know much about the historical background. Did Nome always have a judgeship?
The second division was created at the time of the strike at Nome. And that was where Rex Beach wrote his story, The Spoilers. They made two divisions, and then they made an unattached part where Judge Wickersham served as the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And this Judge Noyes, who was appointed at Nome, and this Alexander McKenzie controlled him, and it went through a very vicious stage there. They had any time that a claim was any good, why, they'd put a receiver on it, and it was pretty tough going. There was a lot of shooting and a lot of trouble of all kinds there, and the United States Army finally declared martial law there. And
what year was that?
1900.
In 1900?
1900 and 1901. They just right through there.
They just sent a bunch of soldiers up
the
there?
The soldiers were stationed there, and they established Fort Davis in 1900 and had two companies stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
Jarvis had been there first with a detachment that was sent over from St. Michael. That was in 1999 when they first really did any mining at Nome. It was founded late in 98. And 99, they started the mine. In 1900, when they struck the beach, the big stampede was on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, where the beach was just covered with men from Hastings Creek clear up beyond Quartz Creek, so that
the fellows that first made that strike, there's some controversy about how they happened to be up there in the first place, isn't there?
Well, the story's been pretty well told and pretty faithfully told. The Lindbergh was one of the men that were hired when the Laplanders were brought over to teach the Eskimos how to herd reindeer.
Mm-hmm.
And when they brought those reindeer over from Lapland, Benderson was who had learned his mining experience up in the around in the in Michigan in the copper mines in through there and all, and the other man, Lindbergh Benderson, and why should I forget that name? Anyway, he had jumped ship at Teller, and they came down to a Swedish mission which was run at Golovin. And there the missionary staked them with a small trading boat and some grub, and they went out prospecting on some reports of gold on the Shinnecock River.
Mm-hmm.
They got a storm and they put it in Nome. And they went back in the hills and found gold on what is afterwards they called Anvil Creek and over in what they called Snow Gulch. And then they staked their claims. And they didn't know about how to go about creating a mining district under the law that existed then. So that Gabe Price had been sent up by Charles D. Lane to investigate the reported strike over an Overcricket Council. And they got him to go with them and show them how to lay out a mining district. And he was allowed, the two Eskimo boys, they didn't know whether they had a right to stake claims or not, but they pulled up the stakes on number 8 and allowed him to stake it. And he went over to the mouth of Snow Gulch and staked what was called the Utica claim for this outfit that had grub-staked him to come in there. And then Charlie Lane came in and bought a boat and called it the Charles G. Lane, and he brought this Wild Goose Mining Company in to work all these claims that they'd got a hold of and bought a lot more. And that was and he was one of the ones that was instrumental in getting this case out to be heard by the circuit court and declared the Judge Noyes in contempt of court and arrested him and brought him back along with Dudley DuBose. And then Wickersham was sent over there to preside while this interim.
Mm-hmm.
Then a man named Moore was appointed judge from Pennsylvania and came in and served there until Moraine was appointed. That is all went through. All this was going on, and litigation of all kind and everything. In the meantime, they struck the second beach line and contests over that. Then they struck the third beach line, and that was the world beater. And that really was a wonderful deposit there.
Yeah, that really started the big boom.
The big boom was in 1900 when they were mining on the beach, because if ever was poor man digging, that was the beach, was it. If you were lazy and wouldn't work if you couldn't make anywhere from $25 to $100 a day on the beach. And at that time, a dollar was a dollar, and gold was on all the gambling tables in the bank. It was stacked up there, and it was real money. It wasn't any of this paper stuff that calls passes for money nowadays. Yeah. I'm a gold man. I believe absolutely in gold, and believe our money should be on the gold basis. I was just out here, Johnny was showing me a book of coins that he's collected, and when I saw those $20 gold pieces he has in his collection, it made my heart ache for the old days, and to know that they passed such a law as that you could mine gold and it wasn't yours when you mined it, when they gave you the right to do it. I'm absolutely opposed to that, and I'm opposed to their issuing this money on a credit basis. I think that it should be based on gold, and gold, if we can't get the other nations to agree to make our own basis and go ahead, because they'll soon come to it.
Well, if that doesn't convince you that there's plenty of fire left in the Alaska sourdoughs, nothing will, because that's Charlie Jones, territorial senator from the 2nd Division, Nome, talking. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we haven't talked too much lately on the subject of mining. And actually, it's a pretty important subject in Alaska. It's probably the one thing that started Alaska on its road to what it has developed into today, an up-and-coming country. We're prone to think that our gold mining has sort of been on the decline because of various and sundry government restrictions on the price of gold and some of the handicaps that the miners are working under, and yet statistics that were revealed this week by the Bureau of Mines indicate that gold mining is once again right up on the top as far as actual money-wise value of products that were, or minerals that were mined in Alaska this past year, 1953. To get back to our subject of mining, we've invited in as our guest a man who's spent 29 years working, I assume, as a prospector most of the time, up around Wiseman, Bettles. I'd like to introduce to you Frank Thiessen. Mr. Thiessen, when did you come into Fairbanks?
1922.
In 1922?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you come to the country first then? Or?
No, 1912 in Juneau.
You landed down in Juneau first?
1912.
Well, what was the condition then? Was the gold boom going hot and heavy?
Oh, yes, it was going hot and heavy when I first came in here in 1922. Of course, Fairbanks was, the FE then was just taking over Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing a lot of work here then, and took over a lot of property here and get work get started. And then I stayed around here until 1925 and went into Keokuk. I've been in the Keokuk ever since.
Well, what is the extent of gold mining activity now in the Keokuk?
Well, there's my partner, Durand, and me, we just took equipment in and opened up Slate Creek this summer, and Andy Schwazdahl and his partner, they went over and opened up Mascot Creek this summer. So that's two more. It's started on opening with equipment this summer up there.
Well, now you say they've opened this summer. Does that mean those areas hadn't been mined in the past?
They've been mined by hand.
Mm-hmm.
You see, there's been handwork done on them, but no equipment.
How long ago?
Well, I think around in 1900, and the last handwork was done well on Mascot Creek. There had been a man working over there right along, Vincent Knorr.
Mm-hmm.
And on my place over there, there's been a little handwork done over there, but besides what I'd done on there. And I was over in there, I started over there in 1930, I think it was.
Now you say equipment. Are you dredges? Is that the type of equipment you're using?
No, we have tractors.
Mm-hmm.
Tractors, and then Myrtle Creek has drag lines. There's one drag line in there.
Yeah. Well, now, how does that type of operation work in contrast to the dredge operation?
Well, that's that type of output works better where the ground is shallow
mm-hmm.
and narrow.
Well, now, your big gold producers, your top producers now, according to these mining statistics we got, are the United States Smelting and Refining at Fairbanks, with Nome running second place.
Yes, ma'am.
And now they use dredges exclusively, don't they?
They use dredges. And then the Strandbergs, they're at Utopia Creek, that's on the Keokuk, that's behind Hughes there. They have washing plants down there at their place. And then Myrtle Creek, they use a drag line for tailings. And when the South Fork was in there, the South Fork Mining Company, they had drag lines and tractors, which they moved out now.
Well, now, are these all considered a type of placer mining?
Yes, it's all placer mining.
Placer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what interested me was that there are, 148 placers, I guess, in operation in Alaska now, and only three load mines. Why is that?
Well, I think there's nobody looks for any load mine back up in where we are, so everything's so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only place that they ever tried much load mining was in the Channel R, ground that used to belong to Governor Seltzer.
Mm-hmm.
He had that ground over there. And there was nice. There's still fairly well quartz, from what I understand, over there from Denny O'Keefe. You know, he's got that quartz ground over there. But it's so expensive to get stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only way, best way is to fly it.
Well, does it take more of a crew to operate a load mine than it does
a
placer mine?
You have so much waste rock and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It'll have to be free gold milling and a stamp mill where they could ship it out by plane. It'd be the cheapest and the best way.
Yeah. Well, what do you see as a future for mining up here? Do you think that the gold mining is ever going to really be the big thing again, or do you think the trend is pretty strong toward the radioactive minerals?
Well, from my standpoint of view, is that the prospectors is gone. There's no more. Now, I've been up in that country there 29 years, and I don't believe there's been three that came in there to prospect. It's just too rough of a go for these young fellas today.
Well, what type of fella? You say that it's too rough for them now. What type of fella is likely to head for the hills to prospect?
Well,
now?
One that wants to, has got to go out and used to roughing it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a lot of knickknacks with you, you know. And got to have a pack on your back and get out in the hills and work.
Well, do you feel that it's because this generation's a little softer than the pioneer generation, or do you feel that times themselves have changed so that it's easier for them to find a softer life?
Well, that's what I think. It's easier for them to go out here and work for wages, and they're sure of it. But when you're out prospecting, why, you never know if you're going to even see a color the whole year. And then you have to depend on some other way to get to come in here and try to get work so he could get some grub, you see. And that, as a rule, that would be pretty hard to do, you know, in the wintertime here to come in and find a job. But they could get another grub stake to go out the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So what we used to do up there, we'd do a little drifting and freighter with the dogs. Them days, before there was no airplane, we'd haul freight with the dogs and trap a little and get a little game and stuff and sink holes.
Just sort of make ends meet during the winter.
Yeah, try to make ends meet, that's all. I had no future to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. And what time of the year would you start up your mining operations again?
As soon as the water had run, as soon as you could.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let me ask you this. When you came up to Alaska, what were you doing in the States that you could just drop and come north?
Well, when I first came up here, I wasn't doing, I was just a young fella, and I worked in a confectionery place there. And then when I went out after the First World War, when I went out, well, then after I was out of the service of Chicago there, well, I went to work back in the confectionery business again. Then I came back here after the war, 22.
Well, did you ever toy with the idea of setting up a similar type of business in Alaska, or did that?
No, I like the outdoors.
You did?
Yeah, I like the outdoors.
I've often wondered about the fellows that came up here to mine, why they didn't maybe try to set up a similar line of trade that they had in the States and Alaska.
Well, it seems like you get out in the hills prospecting and stuff like that, and if you like it, why, there's nothing else you want to do.
Well, tell us about some of your early day experiences up here. You landed at Juneau. Were things, was it?
There were great times them days. Of course, the Douglas Island and all the mines was running, and Juneau was running. Everything was going day and night, plenty of work. There was no worry about getting any work.
Well, was it hard for the mining companies to keep crews, or did everybody want to get out and work for themselves?
No, Juneau down there, it was all hard rock, you know. They were hard rock miners. Of course, a lot of them prospectors out of there, too. You know, they just had worked to get a grub stake, you know, in the wintertime.
Where did most of those men come from in the early days down there? Had they been miners in the States?
Well, they've been miners in the States. A lot of them mined in Montana and copper mines, you know, and the other ore mines in Colorado. I guess a lot of them came over from Europe, you know.
A lot of Scandinavians.
A lot of those European miners from over that country, they were there working in the mines.
Well, can you think of any particularly colorful experiences you've had in Alaska?
Well, the only thing I can think of there, which was kind of interesting, I'll never forget, was Al West was a partner of mine for 5 years up there. Alfred L. West, you know, was with, you might know him here. And we took the first float ship in the Keokuk, Joe Crossan, when they had the one little float ship here. And lit in the river there, where all the natives thought it was, sank. That was very interesting. You see him run around with a rope trying to save us, you know.
Trying to save
us. Yeah,
and
Joe got a kind of kick out of that.
Well, the airplane certainly made it a different kind of a life for the miner, hasn't it?
It has. It has. Well, when before the planes flew, we used to have the scows, used to haul horse scows. Used to haul the freight from Bettles to Wiseman. And then the steamboats, you know, would come up and from the mouth of the river. Sam Dubin had the steamer Teddy H. He had the trading post there. Then in wintertime, when prospectors broke around there, we could always go out and cut little steamboat wood and work on the river scow, you know, make a few dollars. They stayed in the country. But
are you going outside now, or are you one of these miners that winters outside?
kind of figuring on going out.
Where have you been spending your winters out?
Nope, first time last year in 30 years.
Is that right? Did you find things pretty much different, I suppose?
Yes, I did. I found things quite different.
Did you run into many Alaskans while you were out?
Yes, I seen quite a few of them there, especially in Seattle. I was at the Virginia Masons there for surgery, and then I went on down to California.
Glad to get back this spring, I'll bet.
Met my ex-wife and got married again.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, now let me ask, that's something that's always interested me, about a woman's part in a life of a man who's a prospector for nearly 30 years out in the hills. It must take a pretty sturdy kind of a gal to
live
that life.
Yes, there has been quite a few women out in the hills. There's Mrs. Marsan, you go out there and help sink holes, and I've seen quite a few women up there in Wiseman country. You go out there and help sink holes in the wintertime, run the windlass.
Well, are they a pretty contented lot?
Yes,
they seem to like it.
Contented lot. There was one young couple come up to Wild Lake there. That Frank Smith's was there, his nephew and his wife. They were from Chicago, and little Betty took on right away. She had one of the native women learning how to tan a moose hide, so she tanned the moose hide and made her own moccasins.
Is that right?
Yeah, she liked it very well, but she didn't feel very well. She was kind of sickly, so she had to go out. But that's one thing that never has been up there in late years, very many women.
Well, I think that's one of the things that held back Alaska's development. Of course, yeah. I'm breaking my arm patting us women on the back, but you've got to have families, and you've got to have women to have families in order to really have a thriving type of country. Of course, with the airplane now, it's a little different. They can get supplies quicker. And what did you used to do in the winter for supplies? Did you lay up enough stuff in the summer?
Well, when the boats would come up, you see, they bring enough to last the year. And then if you were short, well, you get something from the dog mail from Tanana.
Did you ever hear about anybody making enough hotcakes to last them for a couple of months and freezing them outside the door?
No, I do. It was bread.
Is that right?
In wintertime, yes. Just bake it, and I take it out of the oven and throw it out. The colder, the better. And leave it frozen, and as you bring it in, why, leave it thawed, and it just seems fresh bread.
Well, they don't have to worry about those ice boxes.
No, not in the wintertime. You don't have to worry about any ice boxes. It deep freezes.
Well, before we close, Mr. Thiessen, have you got any comments of your own to make here? I've been doing a lot of talking.
No, but a lot of them seem to think airplanes has hurt the country, and but I don't think it has. I think it's a thing that makes it a lot convenient. Now, like we were up there this summer with Weens, why, every week we had our stuff, and a lot of stuff they just drop out of camp for us, you know, get fresh stuff, otherwise you wouldn't have it.
I can remember a number of instances when Tender Topics has had messages this summer that, well, the grub's going to be out at no grub, and grub's
yes.
going to be here and there,
mm-hmm.
and pick it up
you
before
see,
the wolves
the stuff
do.
Comes into battles on the, on the plane goes through the barrel, you know, the dogs, and,
mm-hmm.
and then they have, we can have a bush pilot there at battles, and then only makes the mail run while he dropped our mail and dropped our stuff, you know. What he could drop, what he couldn't drop, he left up on the field, and we go and pack it down.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we wouldn't have got it, you know.
Well, I want to thank Frank Thiessen for dropping up and talking to us a bit about early day and modern day mining and some of the changes that have taken place in Alaska in the last 30 years or so.